invitation and an introduction to rodeo in South Dakota. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Friday, June 4th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the SDPB Spotlight for June shines on rodeo. We're going to do a little rodeo one-on-one conversation today with Dale Christensen. As you drive through South Dakota, you might be nearly overwhelmed with the majestic scenery and diversity of landscape. Richard Tubbles joins us to talk about diversity and the complicated history of this land and the people who live here. We talk financial therapy and the wellness industry with Rick Kaler. Plus, what's on your South Dakota bookshelf? We ask readers to tell us about our literary heritage. Today's book is The Thresher by Herbert Krause. That's later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. A judge says South Dakota cannot force the federal government to allow fireworks at Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Governor Kristi Noem wants that fireworks show on July 3rd. The National Park Service denied her request. Seth Tupper has been following the story for some time, and he joins us today from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio with more. Welcome, Seth. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
This is the latest in quite a long saga. Imagine that you're driving through South Dakota right now as a visitor. That's the first time you're here. How do you explain Governor Noem's beef about the fireworks show at Mount Rushmore to people?
Well, I would start by going back a little more than a decade and explain that, that long ago, for several years, there were annual fireworks displays at Mount Rushmore. And it was widely viewed as a great thing. We've all kind of seen the images by now of fireworks exploding in color over the faces of Mount Rushmore in the night sky. It's a really cool and majestic thing. And it was really popular while they were doing it, but there were problems. Fireworks embers would come down and start fires in the forest. There had to be wildland firefighters stationed all around Mount Rushmore with backpacks full of water and shovels to find these embers and put them out before they started a big wildfire. Hmm. There was also this chemical called perchlorate in fireworks that when the fireworks fell to the ground, this chemical was leaching into groundwater, and they actually found this chemical, perchlorate, which is toxic, in some of the drinking water wells at Mount Rushmore. So for those and for myriad other reasons, the National Park Service shut down these annual fireworks shows. It didn't have them for more than a decade. Then last year, Governor Noem, who was, as we know, was pretty close with President Trump and an ally of President Trump, asked President Trump for help to bring the fireworks back. He really took to the idea. And last year, they brought him back for the first time in more than a decade. And President Trump came, and they had a big show. Then we switched administrations to the Biden administration, and the state applied for a permit to have the fireworks at Mount Rushmore, which is a National Park Service facility. And this time, the National Park Service said no. And, you know, Governor Noem sued to try to reverse that decision, and this week she lost, at least at the first level in federal court.
She says the decision was arbitrary. The judge says what?
The judge says it was not arbitrary. That was one of the arguments that the state made in its lawsuit, was this decision was arbitrary and capricious. And the judge pointed out that the National Park Service, in denying the permit, actually cited five reasons. They cited the potential spread of COVID-19 at a large public event. They cited tribal opposition to these fireworks. South Dakota tribes formerly possessed all of West River, South Dakota, including the Black Hills, and consider the Black Hills sacred in their traditional spirituality. So a lot of tribal governments are against the fireworks. And so that was one of the reasons cited. The perchlorate problem with the chemical in the fireworks was also cited. Interesting one that the National Park Service cited was actually reduced visitation. They pointed out that when you shut the memorial down and only allow so many people in with tickets as they did last year, that actually means far fewer people see Mount Rushmore on Independence Day or the day before than they usually would, because usually they're cycling through all day, tens of thousands of people. So reduced visitation. They also cited disruption of a construction project out there that's been ongoing for a couple of years to improve the grounds and some of the buildings out there. So there were five reasons. So the judge said, you know, you may disagree with those reasons, but, you know, when they have that many reasons and they cited them all, it's pretty hard to say it was an arbitrary decision.
Right. So we had Superintendent Michelle Wheatley, who is the new superintendent for Mount Rushmore National Memorial. And one of the points she was making, Seth, was that this park is more than the sculpture. The sculpture is what most people think of, but there is also a lot more happening. As someone who has spent, you know, an amount of time at the National Memorial, tell visitors and newcomers, how spacious is this national park and what does it include to you as a resident of the Black Hills?
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting. There is quite an area around it. I mean, it's not just the mountain carving. There's actually you know, an area all around it. And there's a little hiking trail that leads up under the faces. And there's, you know, a visitor center and museum. And there's areas for outdoor presentations. And yeah, I mean, we're in an era now, obviously, where, you know, the way people feel about statues like these is changing. There's more awareness that two of the faces on Mount Rushmore, Washington and Jefferson, were slave owners. You know, there's a greater awareness of tribal opposition to the monument itself. There are some Native Americans in South Dakota who think, you know, carving into this mountain was, you know, four white faces was kind of a desecration of a perfectly good mountainside. And so you've got all that happening, and then you've got, you know, politicians, including former President Trump and Governor Noem, who see Mount Rushmore as a great photo opportunity, you know, to boost their own profile and use it to get their message out. So, yeah, you come there and you get all these, you know, conflicting things happening and all these different ways that people see the monument. It becomes a political football. And that's really what has happened in this whole debate over fireworks now that's been going on for more than a year.
Can you say more about the short term versus long term? Because when you talk about the relationship with tribal communities, tribal governments, and tribal people as individuals, the judge says, you know, that's one of the long-term negative things. The short-term has some benefits. The long-term has some concerns. Spread that out a little bit and say more about that. And then I want to ask, like, what kind of hints we got from this judge about, well, what if it was reversed? And, you know, the Interior Department had said, yes, have it. And there's another lawsuit. Can it help us unpack that a little bit, if you would?
Yeah, so the judge actually acknowledged that probably if you conducted a poll, most people would say just have the fireworks. And so he said, you know, in the short term, it would seem to make sense. But in the long term, he noted in his decision that this could, you know, further fray relationships with tribal governments, you know, over the long term. The perchlorate problem, you know, you may have a certain small increase in the chemicals, you know, in the water this year. That doesn't seem too troubling, but if you keep having fireworks every year, obviously there's a long-term consideration there. So he talked a little bit about things like that, saying that in the short term, yeah, maybe it seems like a good idea. In the long term, there's arguments against it. Mm-hmm. He did say at the very end of his decision that, you know, imagine a situation where the Biden administration, the Park Service said, yes, you can have the permit this year. And somebody who was opposed to it sued to try to stop the fireworks. The judge said in that situation, he would have made the same decision. He would have upheld the Park Service's authority and discretion to decide whether it wants to give a permit or not. Mm-hmm. That was one of the other arguments the Noem administration made, was that they said that the power that Congress has granted the Park Service to make these kind of decisions is unconstitutional. The judge said there's really no basis in law for that. He said clearly Congress can authorize the Park Service to make these kind of decisions about, you know, permits and the uses of national memorials.
Yeah. Governor Noem says she's not done. What happens next?
So she immediately issued a statement this week when the judge's ruling came out, saying that she would appeal. And so, you know, it's too late, you know, obviously, probably to do anything this year. They haven't lined up any fireworks vendors. They, you know, it's too late to organize the event, even if she could somehow appeal and be successful before July 3rd. So I think it's, you know, with an eye toward next year and trying to go to a federal appeals court and get a different decision and maybe have the event next summer.
Seth Tupper, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate this. Is something you've been, how long you've been thinking about this and kind of covering? Does it go back a decade for you too?
Well, this specifically, yeah, a couple of years. But I mean, of course, being a lifelong South Dakotan, I've always been aware of the fireworks there, and so it's yeah. And I've been stuck on the side of the road with an overheated vehicle on July 3rd at Mount Rushmore before. So yeah.
No, thank you on that stuck on the side of the road thing. Seth, thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
We have more In the Moment coming up here in a moment. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to play one of our new favorite features, which is South Dakota Bookshelf. We're asking you, the reader, to come tell us about some of our literary heritage, those quirky or unsung heroes of South Dakota books that we can't interview the author, but we can talk to you about what the book has meant to your life. You're going to hear that a little bit later in the hour. Up next on the program, Rick Kaler is with us. We're going to talk about financial therapy and what it means to the wellness industry. How do those two intersect? You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting. To In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, much has been made about what our next normal will be as we struggle to emerge from our pandemic cocoons of anxiety and our surge of collective reckoning with mortality. Well, how about a great untabooing of our overall thoughts about wellness? Rick Kaler is a personal financial planner, a columnist, and a financial therapy. He has a podcast where he explains why this is not all about the money whenever you talk about money, and he's joining us now with an update. Hey, Rick, thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori, great to be with you again today.
So some interesting news out of, what, the hotel industry and looking at the wellness industry. Explain to me some of the things that you found people are looking at when they look at trends.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. Somehow I came across a hotel magazine article, and it was a report on a wellness summit. And they have the Global Wellness Summit every year. This was held in November of last year. And what really grabbed my attention was what you mentioned, that they said this year there's going to be a great untabooing in wellness, where wellness is going to look past maybe some of the surface things about being whole, about well-being, and really get to what they call the big stuff, yeah, like sex, money, and death. Like, that. And what really, really hit me, because I've kind of been on the ground floor of helping develop financial therapy, yeah, is that this panel said we're going to see people getting real about money with new financial therapy and wellness approaches. Hmm. And financial therapy is so unknown. You know, I've said back when I traveled, if I didn't want to talk, I'd tell people I'm a financial advisor. And if I wanted to talk, I would tell them I'm a financial therapist. And people go, what's that? I've never heard of financial therapy. And to read it, you know, as a major, what's like being identified as a major trend by a group that I think they met in Europe, just really gobsmacked me.
Yeah. So I am fascinated with this idea. You know, a lot of people think about the wellness industry, and I mean, you might think of Jane Fonda in leg warmers back in the 80s, or, you know, Atlas and Charles Atlas, and sort of teaching people how to, you know, even talk about exercise. And now we're at the point where we're saying we're coming out of this pandemic, and all of us have confronted, you know, so many fears and changes and disruptions. It's time to get real. Sex, money, and death.
yeah. We need to throw in politics or religion in that, and we've got everything, right?
Right, but not wellness, because I don't know if politics and religion helps.
Well, it's wellness is a three-stooled event, or three phases to it. It's emotional, physical, and financial. And they're really big, and there's no real profession that you can look at and say this profession is all about all of those areas of wellness.
Yeah.
And it's just huge. And as we've talked before, it's hard for us to separate financial wellness from emotional wellness.
Right.
And I mean, physical is in there, but it's so important. And the financial therapy is going to be a huge player in people really getting well, really getting whole, really making progress in the financial areas where they're stuck in.
Okay, we're not talking about financial abundance or the stock market necessarily. We're talking about something that is more deeply ingrained in us than that. When you're on that airplane and someone says, okay, you have my attention, what exactly is financial therapy? How do you explain it to them?
Yeah, what I say is there anything financially that you ought to be doing that would be in your best interest to do that you're having a real hard time getting done? Overspending is a big one, right? Funding my retirement plan, drawing my will or an estate plan. Those are all real familiar ones. And it's anytime we're stuck, anytime we can't go into action around what is inherently something in our best interest, that's a time to look a little deeper.
Why is it important or beneficial? And I know that you're coming at this from, you know, the perspective of a financial therapist and one of the leaders in this area, but why is it important to work with someone who has some training and some insight into this beyond just sitting down and talking with your regular, you know, financial advisor or your regular therapist about money if you go to any kind of counseling services? How do these worlds meld in a way that would make a difference in your progress? It's worth seeking out the professional support.
Yeah. Most of your financial people just don't have training in the emotional areas, the relational areas. I've said so many times that it's just amazing how a financial issue, when you follow it back, looks like it has nothing to do about the money. And these are often deep conversations that you don't get to in a financial planner's office or your accountant's office or your attorney's office. They're usually, the symptom is dealt with, but not the underlying cause.
Okay.
And so often it's just way more than cognitive. You know, 20% of our financial problems can be solved by just knowing more, but 80% of them aren't about knowing more.
All right. So let's give people an example, and I'll tell you one of my things. I'll be vulnerable today. You can help me pretend that we're talking in a different context. One of the things about this pandemic that I did that many other people didn't do was I bought clothes, and I was working from home. I kept my job, so I had the financial resources that I would normally have for certain expenses. And one of the things I did is every month I found a way to order something to wear to work out of my home office. Nobody ever saw these clothes. I get to wear them at work now, and I'm super happy I did. But it also tied back to this idea that when I was married, I was freelancing, and we always kind of quarreled a little bit, you know, gently about my clothing budget, because my husband at the time was like, well, you don't go to work every day, so you don't really need a lot of clothes. And that bothered me, and we would kind of argue about it. And so here I am in the pandemic. I'm home. I don't technically need a lot of clothes, and I was determined to buy some for me. Help me unpack what was happening with my money beliefs and sort of those things during the pandemic when I was essentially working out of that home office again. One of the first things I returned to was, well, this time I'm buying clothes.
Yeah, there's so many stories that we make up. There's so many times in life that, you know, a money script can be you don't deserve clothes, or, you know, because of this reason that we don't deserve clothes. And things change, circumstances change. Maybe it'd be I can't afford clothes, or I can't afford to pay retail for clothes, or I can't afford new clothes. And all of a sudden we wake up one day and it's like, well, if we wake up,
lucky,
that's
yeah.
not a given. And we go, wow, you know, that person that said we couldn't afford it isn't here in my life anymore, but it's living in my head, right? maybe I kind of had a similar situation where I woke up one day because I had to struggle because I couldn't afford anything. And I'm like, oh, wow, where's this money coming from? It's not supposed to be here.
Right. I don't know what to do with it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then giving ourselves the permission to go ahead while there's parts of ourselves that are just alarmed, like, whoa, you can't afford that. You can't do that.
Right.
And it's working. It's bringing some compassion to those parts of ourselves that really did protect us back then, you know, when, say, we couldn't afford it or it would have caused conflict or whatever was going mm-hmm. on, to say, hey, things are different. And really, it's okay.
Yeah. There was also a ton of inequity during this pandemic because one of the other things that played on my mind was, wow, you're buying yourself a pair of shoes and so many people lost their jobs and they have nothing. Where does my responsibility lie to give this money to someone else versus to do something which essentially I can live without? How do you talk to people about that collective responsibility and sometimes guilt that they can feel, or fear that you could lose your job tomorrow? That there's just a lot happening there, too. What can you say about that?
Oh, man. Do you have 2 hours? I mean, first is to recognize that is there, and to start to get curious, to get curious about how long has that thought been around? Where did that come from? Because it came from some place in our past, and it came from some place when it made sense, when that was an appropriate response to a situation. But as I work with people, Laura, it's just so fascinating when these seemingly illogical behaviors, we can trace them back to something that happened in childhood. For example, I've worked with several clients who couldn't save, but they weren't overspenders, but they couldn't save. In both of these people that were unrelated, we traced it back to in childhood when their parents took what was in their piggy bank or their savings account, and sometimes repeatedly so. One family went into bankruptcy. They took all the kids' money that they had saved. And there's this belief of, oh, I'm not going to save my money anymore because it disappears.
Yeah.
I save money. Yeah. And when we got to that particular episode with one client, like 2 weeks later, she said, oh, by the way, I'm saving money. It's not an issue anymore.
It's not an issue anymore.
So it's like, get curious as to where these came from, you know, and any money script that we talk is a partial truth. It's true in some cases and it's not true in others. Yeah. And it was formed to protect us. It was formed with good intention. But oftentimes it outlives its applicability and its usefulness.
Yeah. I love when you said that about it made sense at the time. So I can sit there and say, wow, it made sense that I didn't buy clothes before, because that would bring up a broader conversation and it caused conflict. And now that is no longer true. And now I can make those decisions based on other factors, like not being too depressed to get out of bed and go to work when you can't leave the house. I don't know.
Yeah.
but this idea that if get curious and be compassionate is what I'm hearing you say, even about the people who maybe rubbed you the wrong way when there was some conflict, you've got to maybe have some compassion toward them as well. Your parents, your spouse, your children, your coworkers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that is true. And I think it's also the hardest person to have compassion toward is typically ourselves.
Yeah.
And I just remember when that's the most foreign concept ever. And my business coach was working with me around it. So one day, and I'm like, I'm frustrated. And he worked with me. And I'm like, I don't get it. How can I bring compassion to these parts of me that, quote, I don't like?
Right.
And it's just it's some work to understand that those behaviors served a purpose, no matter how bizarre or illogical they seem. If we trace it back, it's going to make perfect sense. No wonder I adapted that behavior or that coping mechanism. I've yet to come across one that didn't make any sense.
Yeah. And sort of thanking that part of you that did, said, well, thanks for protecting me from this thing that was stressful. I'm here now and I can deal with it better.
And Lori, that's
I've got the helm.
Profound shift.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
To bring gratitude to ourselves for those parts that we've beaten up, right?
Right.
That we've made not okay, and to have that attitude is incredibly healing.
Yeah. So if you're listening and you're just jazzed up about this like I am, you should listen to Rick Kaler's Financial Therapy podcast and join him on this show as he is with us quite often talking about all these different money beliefs and financial therapy. And it's time to untaboo some of those topics. And where better to start than money? Rick, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Ahead on the program, we take you to the rodeo with Little Rodeo 101. Dale Christensen is with us here this Friday. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. This month, the SDPB Spotlight shines on rodeo in South Dakota. Today, we unpack the complexities of the sport for the uninitiated among us with a little rodeo one-on-one conversation. Well, who better to have that conversation with us than Dale Christensen? He's a longtime rodeo professional. He's the national director for high school rodeo, and he announces for SDPB's high school rodeo coverage as well. Dale, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. First of all, how big is rodeo in South Dakota? How far flung, how popular, economic impact? Like, when you explain the importance of rodeo to others who don't participate in the sport, where do you begin?
Well, South Dakota rodeo is unique. Most of the organizations, associations around the world, around the United States, have started with some influence from somebody from South Dakota. The SDRA kind of got things started. The PRCA patterned their association after that. South rodeo is the official sport of the state of South Dakota. So that's how big it is. Our governor carries a flag at the national finals. That's huge. In high school rodeo, we have the fourth largest membership in the world right now. So as far as the numbers, the popularity of the sport, South Dakota is kind of on the top of the leaderboard right there.
Yeah, and for a population sparse state to be fourth for, participation, that's no small thing.
Oh, exactly. We're very similar in population to Wyoming, Nebraska, North Dakota, but our memberships are double what theirs are, and I don't know why that is. I got an idea. I think it's how we do things. We keep it affordable for our kids here, and that's in high school rodeo. But, South Dakota's got the stock show, Black Hill Stock Show. Sutton's did a great job. They got Rodeo of the Year and the PRCA, Large Indoor Rodeo. Deadwood gets Large Outdoor Rodeo. Kadoka, South Dakota gets WPRA Rodeo of the Year, So South Dakota kind of took all the awards, and last year was a little different, but we got to stay open and do what, use our common sense and have some fun in the summer like we're supposed to.
Yeah, so staying open and the new economic development, talk a little bit about that, the future that some of that COVID relief money and Governor Noem's push to expand and invite more rodeo into the state. Look ahead a little bit for us and say, we're starting at a pretty high platform, but we can grow more and be more influential than we already are.
Well, I think the way Governor Noem has really helped us is inviting people, telling everybody that South Dakota is open. They're coming here to vacation. You can't hardly get a motel room here in the hills. They're full. I was on my way home from Rapid to Kadoka the other day. The interstate looked like the bike rally was going on with campers headed out for Memorial Day. Yeah. People know we're here. They know we're using our common sense. Come here, enjoy life, and get back to normal. And, as far as the economic part of it, we've been open. We don't understand, we don't see a lot in our area. I don't understand how the businesses can stay shut down, and I feel for them, believe me. But as far as our end of the our end of the rodeo spectrum. We're business as usual, and we want people to come watch it because it's going to be bigger and better.
Let's explain to people what they're coming to watch. So rough stock timed events. Let's start there.
Well, most events started on the ranch earlier. You know, in the olden days, the ranchers would get together with their hired man and they'd have contests. You know, they'd ride bronc, they'd ride a saddle horse. The best rider won that. It was bragging rights. They'd rope calves, they'd team rope. You know, all the events in the arena, other than the, you know, you'd say maybe the barrel racing didn't originate on the ranch, but that's a true spectator sport. The barrel racing, it shows the horse less that these ladies ride, you know. But the calf roping, that's how the ranchers, you know, administered the vaccine and the health treatments to their livestock. The team roping, the larger animals, the cows. You know, sometimes you're 15 miles from a set of pens, and it's just easier to rope that critter out there in the pasture and take care of what the needs are for that animal. The rough stock, you know, the bull riding, that just come, I suppose, at late hours some evening after some adult beverages, you know, because that's the only thing I can figure. But the crowd loves it, you know. It's just something extreme. And, you know, who's more crazy than a bull rider and to ride a 2,000-pound mad animal, you know?
What are some of your earliest memories of rodeo for yourself in your life?
Oh, my parents were not really technically, they weren't rodeo people, but they were involved with putting on rodeos. He was very instrumental in building the Canoka Arena there, and they started putting on some Little Britches rodeo there and producing them, and Rodeo Bible Camp in Canoka, they helped with that. And my love of rodeo just started from that. I remember, I tell you what, the my very first memory of rodeo was a spanking. And I wanted to take my horse into town to the rodeo, and I was just little, and I got there, and I got scared, and I didn't run. And my dad says, "You said you were going to do this," and that's how it didn't end well for me, you know. But it's a memory, and that's my earliest one, good or bad.
How old are you when this happened?
How old was I?
Yeah, guess.
Oh, I was probably four. You know, wow. 4 or 5.
That's an early, early lesson.
So, it was. You know, when you say you're going to do something, you do it. And that's the way I've lived my life after that, I think.
All right. So when people are coming to be spectators, you're coming in to say into a new world. You don't know what you're looking at. You see things that you don't understand. You don't know why the horse is bucking, or you're worried about the health of somebody, or what happened to that goat. Like, tell somebody how to come into this space and observe and watch in a way that respects the rodeo and that also kind of helps, you know, figure out how to enjoy it when you don't really know what the points are based on, other than something like, you know, barrel racing. Hey, it's fast. You know,
right.
I can tell the time. Yeah.
Well, as an announcer, I try to explain that because my job is to make the crowd enjoy the rodeo and explain it to them. And like you said, a lot of people come in and do not understand what we're doing.
Yeah.
So I'll explain it there. But if somebody's coming in and really wants to know, find somebody with a dirty old hat on their head that doesn't look like they just bought it in town and ask them. And the rodeo people are an amazing group of people. They will tell you why that horse is bucking, what the flank strap actually does. You know, it's a fleece lined piece of leather that wraps around their flank area. It doesn't pinch anything, but it makes them kick. You know, it's a, you know, why they're tying the calves like that, why they in the steer rest on the, you know, the different things that we do to protect our livestock, because some of these horses are worth $50,000 to $100,000. These bucking horses, they'll buck once a month. You know, some of the better ones, these guys are making their living off that livestock, and they want to take care of it. So we're not abusing them, and that's so far from the truth. And it's very frustrating when that gets out there and people take that run, because that's not what we're about in the rodeo world and the Western world.
Yeah. Any final thoughts you want to leave us with? A frequently asked question that you want to clear up. What makes this fun, and when does it click for you? I mean, I always compare it to hockey, because the first time I watched hockey, I was like, I couldn't even see the puck. And then, you know, sat with my brother who loves the Red Wings, and all of a sudden there's one moment where I'm like, oh, I'm on that next level of being able to understand and enjoy hockey. Where is that next level if you're a newcomer to say, oh, now I see something that I didn't see about technique or something like that?
Well, and like I said, sit with somebody, ask us some questions. I'll be glad to take people around and show them what we do, because just like me, I've been to one hockey game in my life. There was no fights, and I was disappointed. You know? But I do not understand the game. So I can understand people coming in. But, you know, ask anybody in the arena. We're proud of what we do. Any committee out there, any announcer, any rancher from South Dakota is proud of what we do. And they would be more than glad to educate somebody on the sport that we love so much here in South Dakota.
All right, and don't wear a brand new white cowboy hat.
Exactly. Hey, and one thing, if you do come to the rodeo, you don't have to try to look like a cowboy if you're not. Just come as you are. I mean, we're real people, and we like real people.
I love it. Dale, thank you so much. It's always a delight to have you on the program. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Up next, SDPB's Richard Tubbles talks about the complicated history and landscape of this place we call South Dakota. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, when you look at a map of the United States, that place outlined as the state of South Dakota was originally carved from the lands of sovereign tribes. Those tribes still exist today, and they share the same geography with South Dakota's non-native residents. When it comes to diversity, South Dakota has a lot to offer its residents and visitors. Think of the roaring waters at Falls Park in Sioux Falls, or the Dignity Statue who gazes upon the Missouri River and the bluffs near Chamberlain. Think of the magnificent Black Hills, referenced glancingly in a song by the Beatles. There's a lot to do here and experience in this state, but to understand how South Dakota came to be the way it is, you must first understand history. SDPB's Richard Tubbles joins us now to talk about that historical perspective and what it means for him to be a Native American who grew up in this state. Richard, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Lori. Thank you for that introduction. I am, I'm an enrolled member of the Ogallala Lakota tribe out of Pine Ridge Reservation, and I was born in Rapid City, but I grew up in a variety of places due to my father's career in law enforcement with the BIA, and I lived on many reservations, and I can attest to the experiences. It's one that is universal to Native Americans. I feel that as a people, we are still misrepresented and often looked down upon. And I recently had a conversation with this gentleman named Christopher Bordeaux. He's a retired Lakota tribal educator, and he had an interesting perspective on what diversity means to him.
All that pops in my head is all the racism I've dealt with my whole life. And it's almost like, well, people of color, it's racism, but for other, like, German people and Dutch people, and that's the diversity that I think people look at. There are a lot of people who see diversity as people of color in South Dakota. I mean, they're not in those positions, and if they are, they usually keep their mouth shut. A lot of people in South Dakota still have no idea what that means, and to them, it's like immigrants coming in, and, you know, we're invisible to them, and we're less than them.
So, Richard, powerful words there from Chris Bordeaux. With a situation that was created by Manifest Destiny and Western expansion, forceful removal of Native Americans onto smaller and smaller carved-out reservations in the 1800s, what's something that happened during this area that was just lost during all of that process?
Well, Lori, I think the biggest thing that comes to mind in regards to the state and, you know, the history that not only affected Native Americans here, but it was something that was pretty universal across the continent. And you have these boarding schools that young natives were forced to attend, that they had to be assimilated into this so-called European culture that was happening at the moment with, like you said, Manifest Destiny and Western expansion.
It's got to be a ongoing conversation, and because we know everything about non-Native people because that's what we learned in growing up. And we have to unlearn all of that and be able to live that way. And it, you know, and a lot of the young people are getting there, but a lot of the young people still have that Western way of thinking. They have to win, and it's not about winning. It's about understanding each other. I could go on for days.
Richard, we're going to have to leave it there. In our last 20 seconds, you know, what is your advice for somebody who's just coming through the state, traveling here for the first time, and really thinking about this for the first time?
You know, Lori, I think one of the biggest things is there's a lot of culture here that has existed for thousands of years prior to the state becoming a state. And I think one of the biggest things is, you know, if they're here to see what Native America has to offer is to buy authentic Native American arts and crafts and support those families that sell that stuff, because sometimes that's the only income that some of these Native Americans have.
Yeah. Richard Tubels, SDPB's Richard Tubels, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time. Look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you.
Dive into our literary heritage today with a look at the state's iconic, lesser-known, and even quirky literary offerings. This is a segment we're calling South Dakota Bookshelf, and it's where we talk with readers about the books that opened doors for them or maybe even made them rethink their Midwestern identities. Today's book is called The Thresher by Herbert Krauss. Today's reader is Patrick Hicks. He's writer in residence at Augustana University, where Herbert Krauss was the first writer in residence. And of course, Hicks is also an author. But today, let's just talk with him as a reader.
You can go to the archives of the Center for Western Studies, and there's just boxes of Herbert Krauss's notes. If memory serves me, some of his journals. I have this vague memory of holding his American passport. So we have an awful lot of these literary artifacts at the Center for Western Studies, which is really kind of fun to look at.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, the book we're going to talk about today is The Thresher.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit, is The Thresher a machine or a person?
Oh, good. Good. technically, it's a machine, but I like your take that it could be a person. It was published in 1946, and it became a national bestseller. And it's about the German-American community here in Minnesota and South Dakota and sort of how they sort of operated. And it's interesting if you think about it. This comes out in 1946, you know, very shortly after the defeat of Nazism and Nazi Germany. And the novel takes place in between the late 1800s and early 1900s. Mm. So it's interesting to me that it becomes this national bestseller. In spite of the fact that we had just defeated Nazi Germany, and this is all about the German immigrant community in Minnesota.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, and he knew that's what he was doing at the time. He had written it long before and published it then. Tell me a little bit more about what, you know, how the German Americans are really presented in The Thresher then.
Yeah, it took him 7 years to write The Thresher. He started in about 1938, 1939. So, I mean, the war is definitely on his mind while he's writing this. But he was born in 1905 into a German-American community. And, of course, he would have come of age during World War I, also known as the Great War. And there was great anti-German immigrant bias and hatred at that point in time. So it's a really interesting sort of take, seeing how he very lovingly but realistically portrays the community from which he comes from, the German-American community. And he kind of slots that into American history in the beginning of the 20th century as well. So we've got Ole Rolvaag, who wrote about the Norwegian experience in Minnesota. And Herbert Krauss does pretty much the same thing, but with the German-American literary experience. And in fact, we have Rolvag's Cabin at Augustana University, and they just missed each other because Rolvag very, very nearly became Herbert Krauss's teacher at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota.
Interesting. Who's our protagonist in The Thresher?
Well, his name is Johnny Schwartz, and we don't know much about his father. He seems to be a shadowy sort of, you know, menacing figure, and we really don't know much about him. And really, this is a buildings roman. So we follow Johnny Schwartz as he goes from a kid to, you know, a young adult to being fully adult, and he's coming into his own. He ultimately changes his name to Johnny Black, and he's fascinated by these threshing machines, which is high modernity at the time. I mean, think about these roaring monsters of tractors in the early 20th century. I mean, everything would have been cut by hand, and then suddenly you have this machine which can take down crops within a matter of hours instead of days or even weeks. And Johnny Schwartz, or Johnny Black, he becomes fascinated with this. And the novel is really about the rise of modernity in Minnesota and the oncoming of the 20th century. But it also has some really hard questions about what is the cost of chasing your dreams. And Johnny really goes against the German-American community in the sense that he works on the Sabbath. He'll do business with people who are non-German. So he's really kind of radical in that respect. So it's this wonderful collision of the 19th and 20th century.
How does it speak to us today?
For me, it speaks to this sense of ambition and drive and what we might be willing to give up in order to achieve what we might really desire. In a close-knit community, can you have a rags-to-rich story when everyone knows you and maybe people are trying to undermine you? Mm-hmm. The Thresher is also just this wonderful literary artifact of a period of time that has receded in our imagination. And it's, I think, good to sort of revisit that particular point in time.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like about The Thresher is it reminds me, paradoxically and in a strange way, about the kind of novels that came out of England in the late 19th century. I'm thinking of George Eliot, Thomas Harding, where they write really lovingly about the slower pace of life there, but there's modernity approaching on the horizon with these new machines which threaten the past.
I love it. What kind of writer is Krauss? Can you read something for me?
I've got a few sentences that, as a writer, I'm really struck by Krauss. He's obviously, he writes prose, but there's a poetic sensibility about how he approaches things. So here are some of sentences from The Thresher that I read more like poetry. The whip in his hand uncoiled and licked out like a snake's tongue, exploding in a pistol shot of sound. Or how about this one? Johnny watched the spark in old Gephardt's pipe spread to a scab of red ember. And I particularly like this one. The creek hurried over shallow stretches noisily with gurgling, sucking sounds and slowed to smooth. You hear all those O's.
Yeah.
You know, it mirrors the sound. So I see in Krauss not just someone that is really invested in sort of chronicling his childhood in Minnesota, but I see someone that is a true literary artist.
That's Patrick Hicks talking about the book The Thresher by Herbert Krauss. Patrick, by the way, wrote the most recent introduction for the latest edition of The Thresher. You can find The Thresher on the shelves of your local library. Ask a librarian to show you to the South Dakota section. Would you like to join me on air to celebrate our state's literary heritage? Send me an email and tell me about one of your favorite South Dakota books. I'm at inthemoment@sdpb.org. Let's talk about what's on your South Dakota bookshelf.
You cried, now we're sidebusters, my dear, we are home. I cried silently. So alone.
And the music you heard in that segment, South Dakota artist Jamie Lynn. The song is called Sodbusters. We used it today with the artist's permission. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Special thanks today to Steve Munson and Seth Tupper. On the next In the Moment, Joe Santos takes us into the wild world of cryptocurrency on Monday Macro. From Chris Loffrey, Steve Zwimke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.